Previously on Robbery, Inc., his cat-and-mouse game would come to an end a month later when he was finally captured by FBI agents in New Orleans. Again, found with an arsenal of shoulder weapons, handguns, and bulletproof vests.
Anyone with information as to Morris Lynn Johnson's whereabouts is asked to call the nearest FBI office.
He celebrated his latest escape with joyful postcards he mailed to FBI agents, a judge, and the prosecutor in one of his upcoming trials.
I'm a bank robber.
The duo managed to scale the 40-foot prison wall using bed sheets and scraps for a makeshift ladder. In April 1974, a group of thieves tunneled beneath Roswell Street in Marietta, Georgia, and blasted their way into the Cobb Exchange Bank vault, only to be mocked for escaping with just $1,000. But as investigators dug deeper, they uncovered a far bigger mystery and the story of a career bank robber whose daring heists and prison escapes made him a legend. This is Robbery, Inc., from Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Marietta Daily Journal.
I think that's, you know, so when you're talking about old Marietta, it's like everything was just casual. Life was easy, like was casual. And to have something like that, it was just like, I think just Southerners in general, you just like, if they're just always, their backup is always going to be humor.
I was born in a small town, and I live in a small town. Probably die in a small town. Oh, those small communities. I can't take credit for those lines. It's from John Mellencamp's Small Town, a 1985 hit that served as an anthem for Middle America. I grew up listening to that song, my father having been raised in a small Indiana town just a short drive away from Mellencamp's, at the bottom of the state boot. If you're from Indiana like my father, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, and Morris Lynn Johnson, chances are you know the lyrics by heart. If there's one thing I can say about small town culture for those of you who've never experienced it, there's real truth in the phrase, word travels fast. You can tell a tale at dinner time and it's traveled three towns over by the time your head hits the pillow. Multiply that by today's technology, and it seems like the world is one big small town. Whether you're from a big city or a rural community, there's something inherently human about storytelling. That's what all those cave drawings, hieroglyphics, fables, tales, and parables are really about. Connecting with each other through stories, across cultures and time. You don't have to be from a small southern town like Marietta to understand that. The story we've been telling you in four episodes so far is just as much facts and figures as it is legend and myth. It wouldn't be right to tell you one side of it without the other. So as us Southerners like to say, why don't you sit a spell? We've got a story to tell, and rumor has it, you're going to want to hear this. You're listening to Robbery, Inc., Episode 5, Rumor Has It. I'm your host, Madison Elizabeth Hogan. We last left off discussing the harrowing tales of our leading outlaw, Morris Lynn Johnson, who might be proof that fact is truly stranger than fiction. To recap MLJ's extensive criminal record, we know he started his career as early as 20 years old in Indianapolis. He spent the better part of 4 years in and out of cop cars and jail cells, sticking up banks to pay off his lawyers and make bail, robbing Peter to pay Paul and the like. Police, media, and Indy residents regarded him as a suave James Dean bandit rather than your run-of-the-mill derelict. MLJ was the brazen leader of a 100-person criminal enterprise dubbed Robbery, Inc. by law enforcement, responsible for more than 3,400 crimes in the Midwest from 1958 to 1963. He was finally pinched for a big bust in 1962 after knocking over the Merchants National Bank and Trust Co. MLJ confessed to nearly 300 crimes while in custody, but claimed he never robbed the Merchants National Bank. After his publicity circus in Indy, where he tried to obtain restraining orders against every politician and lawman of the land that would dare oppose him, he was finally sentenced to 18 years in federal prison. MLJ broke out of the Atlanta Penitentiary in 1966 and again in 1975, both times escaping with fellow criminals and scaling the 40-foot prison wall with makeshift ladders. He was the first person to escape twice in the prison's history. He burglarized the Cobb Exchange Bank in Marietta and robbed another bank in DeKalb County, Georgia, along with countless others in Indiana and Kentucky. His known associates were Laura K. Johnson, his wife, Leon Johnson, his brother, Frank Rance, his wheelman, and fellow robbers like J. Paul Scott and Jesse James Roberts, to name a few. MLJ caused a racket in 1976 when he graced the FBI's top 10 most wanted list, evaded capture after a shootout with agents in Mississippi, and was finally apprehended in New Orleans. He closed out the year when he testified in his brother's robbery trial, escaped prison a third time in Alabama, and managed to send off a few farewell postcards to law enforcement for the holidays, and a partridge in a pear tree. He was handsome, cunning, and brazen. A compulsory thief and a chronic escape artist, there was no bank or prison MLJ wouldn't dare try to break in or out of. And to make matters worse, he had a wicked sense of humor. But the folks back in Marietta were left none the wiser to MLJ's notorious crimes and legendary status as a stick-up man. For all intents and purposes, some crazy fools dug 135 feet up into a safe deposit vault for 2 months, spending money on food, supplies, and rental space, only to leave with enough to break even. If they'd been doing honest work, they would have been better off. As far as OMs were concerned, they had a funny anecdote to discuss at the dinner table that evening and slept soundly that night, knowing their money was safe and sound. Just take this letter to the editor that ran in the Marietta Daily Journal a day after the Cobb Exchange burglary hit the wire.
The robbery of Cobb Exchange Bank by a trio who worked for 2 months in tunneling under the street from a rented building to reach the bank vault sounds very much like an old Alex Guinness movie in which only frustration rewarded the perpetrators. To dig for 2 months and only get $1,000 means about $333 each for backbreaking digging and dirt carrying. That figures at about $5 a day, which isn't very high wages for a ditch digger these days. And, if you must add, the risk and danger of digging under a busy street where rumbling traffic might break through the tunnel. In the Guinness movie, the professor laid out a careful and elaborate plan to stage a big robbery. But after the gang got the money, the members, one by one, got their just desserts. Finally, Guinness, as the ringleader, fell from a bridge onto a coal car and was carried off, finis. Then, too, you must figure the digger's expenses. They paid some $1,500 in rent for the building and bought fried chicken, beer, and other goodies to live on. You all know about the high cost of living, so they ended up considerably in the red. They'd better stick to honest pursuits such as ditch digging, grave digging, farm digging, and give up the bank digging. They'll come out better financially.
Folks around town weren't the only ones laughing all the way to the bank. Police, bank personnel, and even Arthur Crow, the owner of the building the burglars rented out to form the tunnel, were in on the joke. Here's what MDJ columnist Bill Kenny wrote about exchanges between law enforcement, Crow, and Cobb Exchange Bank president Neil Barfield at the scene of the crime.
I can't recall ever before being sorry for bank robbers. But you can't imagine the trio's frustration after digging for 2 months to tunnel 127 feet from Arthur Crow's building, under Roswell Street and up into the Cobb Exchange bank vaults, only to get about $1,000. Why, that's about $5 a day, less than the minimum wage. And they had already paid $1,500 in rent, plus buying digging equipment, purchasing victuals, and other necessities. They would have been better off depositing $1,500 at the bank and drawing interest on it. They truly went into the hole, two ways. There was some talk at the scene that it might have been an unemployed Georgia Tech engineer or two. But a bright University of Georgia grad pointed out that had it been a tech man, the tunnel would have ended up under Wilder Little's Marietta Federal's vault, up the street in the opposite direction. Another onlooker suggested that it might have been some MARTA workers. MARTA had been trying to tunnel into Cobb for years. However, this theory was quashed when it was pointed out that the tunnel had been dug in 2 months. Everybody knows MARTA couldn't work that fast. Another expert said that robbers knew plenty about engineering, but not much about banking, because they missed the bank's cash vault. There was speculation that some Watergate burglars might be involved since the job was so badly bungled. First they blow Watergate, now they blow, that's a double pun, son, Cobb Exchange, an apparent Democrat surmised. Congratulations, Neil, you're the first banker in Cobb held up with a shovel, someone remarked. I'm so chicken a robber could hold me up with a pencil, replied the genial young president of the Cobb Exchange. Then there was insurance executive Bill C. Island Smith, who chuckled, I can't wait to see the expression on Arthur Crowe's face when he sees these rooms filled with red clay. Bill, it's your face on which I want to see the expression when Arthur tells you, as his insurance agent, to put all that dirt back in the tunnel, another cad exclaimed. Soon, Crow arrived on the scene and joined in the partying. Arthur, how are you going to fill up that tunnel? Barfield asked Crow. You can just stuff it full of money, Neil, Crow replied.
But we know from police records that our bandits did not, in fact, leave empty-handed. Closer to $22,000, at least $9,000 of which was in cash. The booty was mostly late deposits of checks and cash left in the safe deposit vault during the final shift that Saturday. Though the public was still led to believe by reporters and police that the stolen amount was only $1,000, rumors started spreading about the true state of the safe deposit boxes when news about the burglary began to dry up. MDJ columnist Fred Delves immortalized those rumors in an op-ed titled, Did Diggers Really Leave Empty-Handed?
We've all been enjoying a good laugh over the story of how a group of fellows, three or maybe four of them, spent so much money and so much time and so much effort digging their way below Roswell Street only to come up inside the wrong vault at Cobb Exchange Bank. The actual tunneling, it must be conceded, was a fantastic, well-engineered operation. How many of us could have dug a straight trench for 136 feet on top of the ground, let alone dig a straight line tunneling below it? Even MARTA's engineers aren't going to attempt it, even with their sophisticated equipment, when someday in the future they prepare downtown Peachtree for the subterranean movement of rapid transit trains. They're going to dig a massive hole, working downward, build the tunnel at the bottom of the trench, then fill the hole back in. Our Roswell Street tunnelers cut their underground passage without inconveniencing traffic at all. A friend of mine proffers that perhaps what they really wanted was in one of the safe deposit boxes and not the vault. Maybe without too much trouble or residual evidence. They got what they really wanted. Only the renter of their particular box would know, or maybe he or she hasn't found out yet. Federal regulations require that the bank and similar institutions now report an individual's cash deposit of more than $10,000. A lot of folks don't know this, but it's true. So anybody who doesn't want his cash banking transactions probed by the federal investigation would probably find a safe deposit box far more convenient than a banking account. What big-time gambler, for example, would want to keep running into the bank with cash deposits of $9,999 just to avoid the federal surveillance? That would mean 35 trips or more just to stash away $250,000 and could create even worse suspicion. The whole sum could be slipped into a safety deposit box in a single visit. So could any large sum of money, which it was decided should be kept out of one's personal income tax records. A bank, of course, doesn't know what its customers keep in their safety deposit box. Could it be that someone is using a box at the Cobb Exchange Bank hasn't found out yet what has happened to its contents? Or could it be that the particular individual already knows but doesn't dare tell anybody? My friend has an interesting theory.
As Delves posits in his column, safe deposit boxes are regarded as a legal no man's land. In 2019, the New York Times reported that there were roughly 25 million of these boxes in banks across the country, and no federal laws regulating them. Customers aren't required to report what's in them, and bank personnel don't know their contents. If a client opens their box to find their coveted materials are missing, there's no compensation, no legal recourse. Whether contents are stolen or destroyed, a customer is pretty much SOL. In fact, a customer at the Cobb Exchange Bank claimed this very thing happened to him in 1973, just 7 months prior to the tunnel burglary. Johnny Patisse and his wife Mary sued the bank, claiming more than $100,000 was stored in a safe deposit box in late 1972. To put that in perspective, that's over $700,000 in today's terms. That's a ridiculous amount of cash, right? Here's what Johnny Patisse discovered when he tried to access the box months later, according to court records.
He had given his key to the box to his attorney. He had the safe deposit box drilled open on September 11, 1973, after he had gone to the attorney for the key and was informed that it had been misplaced. When the safe deposit box was opened, it contained only one rubber band. The defendant testified that a bank vice president assisted him in placing the money in the box and was present when the box was opened and exclaimed, "Johnny, I swear to you, I don't know what's happened." The bank officer denied both allegations.
The court would ultimately rule in the bank's favor. There's that legal no man's land. By late spring of 1974, the discourse around town was whether the bank burglars intended to end up in the safe deposit box vault. Here's Peggy Crow explaining the vault setup in the bank.
So I think there's a misconception, especially in the articles, that these guys went right up into the vault, which is not true. So can you kind of describe why there's a different room with the safety deposit box in the vault? Can you describe what that looked like in the bank?
I think in general, most banks are going to have a separate room for safe deposit box and then a separate room for the vault. I doubt that I ever went into the vault. That would not have been something that I would have been privy to. But any teller would have gone into the safe deposit room with keys and let somebody in to do things. We would leave them by themselves, but we would let them in and then close it behind them.
So safety deposit boxes aren't really popular anymore, but at the time, were they a popular item?
Absolutely. Anything you had that was of value was going to be in a safe deposit box.
And would you say majority of bankers would utilize those safety deposits?
Yes.
The theory that Delves explores in his op-ed has lasted in the OM community for more than 50 years. When I first started to investigate the Cobb Exchange Bank burglary in 2021, this rumor was one of the first pieces of the puzzle. Did the burglars make off with more than what police said? Were these safe deposit boxes targeted? But Dells plays it a little close to the vest in his column. He writes about only half the rumor. According to the local grapevine, it wasn't just the safe deposit box vault that was targeted. It was one man's box in particular. Let's go back to Bill Kenny's column on the jokes heard in the bank tunnel that day.
Someone suggested that Crow should call wealthy attorney Harold Willingham and tell him the mission of the robbers was to break open and steal the contents of Willingham's safe deposit box. Crow tried to get Willingham via phone. Discovering him at Crystal River, Florida on a fishing trip, Crow left Willingham's secretary this message to relay to Willingham. Robbers tunneled from my building to your safe deposit box at Cobb Exchange. Stop. Robbers got the cash, but we saved all your confidential papers. You can get your papers on return from the FBI. But an onlooker snapped, "Hell, Willingham won't believe that story. Harold knows three burglars alone wouldn't be strong enough to tote off his safe deposit box." I don't guess I ever saw so many folks enjoy a bank robbery.
Harold Willingham. This was a name that always floated around the tunnel burglary. Rumor has it that Mr. Willingham, of the OM Willinghams, was an exceptionally successful attorney with an abundance of cash. The gossip about where this extra flush of cash came from changes depending on who you speak to, but the general consensus is it was from gambling winnings. The friend with an interesting theory that Delves mentions in his column is allegedly Otis Brumby Jr., the owner of the Merida Daily Journal.
Tell me a little bit about the rumors about Harold Willingham.
Daddy was one who just really liked to get under people's skin and just get a rise out of them. And when he found out that they had come into the safe deposit box area, and I guess Harold had come to check it out, and he was like, "Harold, this is terrible because they've stolen all of your money at the safe deposit box." And I thought that Harold was going to have a nervous breakdown and just have a heart attack right then. And that was absolutely his goal, to get a rise out of him like that, which obviously that didn't happen, but it made for a good story.
For people who don't know who Harold Willingham is, how would you describe him?
Harold Willingham was another character, too. You know, when you look up things about everything he did, it's like, you know, when you grow up with people, they're just somebody you know. You have no idea who they are and what they did. You know, when I think about Harold, we would take his RV and go to the University of Georgia football games. So when I think about Harold, I think about that.
Do you know how Harold actually ended up making a lot of his money? Because that's kind of the rumor around town, is like, how did Harold have all this money?
You know, it's kind of like people had money and nobody ever knew where it came from. It just, you know, it's just like they have money and they have money. So, you know, I have no idea how he made money. But everybody said that he kept cash. But again, you know, people give you cash. It's kind of like now. You just kind of sweep it under the rug. Don't tell the IRS about it.
I also spoke to Buddy Darden, a former Georgia congressman and lawyer who served as the Cobb County District Attorney in 1974 when the Cobb Exchange Bank was burglarized.
I was District Attorney in Cobb County when this occurred, and of course it was very much the talk of the town. And I remember several things about it. Of course, I knew Ms. Abernathy, who was the assistant cashier who reported the event. I was also personally acquainted with Officer Donnie Ellers, who was a member of the Marietta City Police Department, but also worked part-time as a security guard at the Cobb Exchange Bank. Incidentally, the Cobb Exchange Bank eventually combined with the Bank of Smyrna and became the first Bank of Cobb, is my best recollection, but the Cobb Exchange Bank, of course, is no longer in existence. The president was a very close friend of mine, Neil Barfield.
Even as an established member of the community and the chief representative for the state in criminal cases, Buddy had never heard of MLJ, his accomplices, or the inner details of the case. When I showed him the police reports from the burglary, it was the first time Buddy had seen them.
Incidentally, no state charges were ever filed. And as you well know, there are state crimes and there are federal crimes, and many times they are concurrent situations. This would be considered a burglary under Georgia state law. But also, since a national bank was involved, or a bank that was insured by the FDIC, it would also constitute a federal crime. And my best recollection is that the Federal Bureau of Investigation and perhaps the Comptroller of the Currency and others took over the case, and so no state charges were ever made. Of course, I know you see Law and Order on television. The way it works, and the way it worked back then in particular, is that the policemen made the cases, investigated them, and then brought them to the DA. And, of course, no case was ever brought to me on this case. And I frankly found out more about it since I've seen these reports. And and heard about a subsequent arrest being made. I found out more since we started talking about it than I knew at the time or ever learned. I remember there was a lot of discussion about the fact that the burglars didn't get any money, and there was a lot of rumors around that there were some people who had safety deposit boxes that were entered into, and perhaps some of the money was stolen out of them.
That's right. Buddy was also privy to these deposit box rumors.
In particular, the name you heard most often rumored around town was Harold Willingham, and apparently he had some cash and jewels and so forth stored there. But since he and your publisher, Otis Brumbert Jr., were very, very close friends, you would have never seen anything about that in the Marietta Daily Journal. I think he also had served maybe as an attorney for the paper at one time, but he and Mr. Brummer were very close friends, and you didn't see anything very much about Mr. Willingham in the Marietta paper.
To get to the bottom of this, I spoke to Judy McCall Smith, the stepdaughter of Harold Willingham. Judy wasn't able to sit down for a recording with us, but she was able to tell me a little bit about her stepfather. He married her mother in 1952, after her father died in a plane crash. He was an instrumental part of Cobb County, serving in the Georgia House of Representatives and making the push to complete I-75, the main interstate that runs through Cobb County to downtown Atlanta. Though she couldn't say for certain if Harold had a safe deposit box at Cobb Exchange Bank or that he ever gambled, she did confirm that he had a lot of money due to investments and business. She described him as, quote, a character who told it like it was and wasn't always liked. Judy confirmed he was friends with Otis Brumby Jr., but that they didn't always get along. Throughout all my research, as prevalent as these stories are, it's impossible to say where these rumors began about Harold Willingham, other than the jokes mentioned in Bill Kinney's column. Hearing these stories and op-eds, I'm reminded of a class I took in college, in a small town not unlike Marietta in many ways. This class reviewed some of the greatest stories in modern journalism, and often included visits from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. If you don't know anything about a Pulitzer, think of it as like an Oscar for an actor. It's one of the highest awards you can achieve in the field. This particular class was taught by Tom French, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who had a knack for storytelling, as screeners only dreamed about. I remember one discussion in particular when Tom asked us about the purpose of journalism, newspapers in particular. Why might someone keep a newspaper after reading it? He asked. I made an argument that one of those purposes is to preserve history, but Tom disagreed. He pointed out that when covering significant historic events, journalists often get the details wrong the first time around. I'll be honest, I thought he was being argumentative. But it wasn't until I had real-life experience in the field myself that I understood what Tom was getting at. You might have noticed that in a number of these newspaper readings we've played for you, that certain details tend to change. For example, in some stories, the tunnel was reported to be 127 feet long. In others, it's 135 feet. So, which is it? For all intents and purposes, I believe that tunnel was 135 feet, because that's the length included in the Marietta Police reports and the final length in our newspaper archives. I think it's one of those details that was incorrect when initially reported and then corrected as the story progressed. But this story is more than 50 years old. That tunnel was filled to the brim weeks later with a concrete mixture. I can't go down under Roswell Street and measure the tunnel for you. As a journalist, I want to report the truth. But what happens when the truth can't outpace the rumors? Nearly a month after the burglary, Bill Kinney would report that $22,000 in checks and cash were stolen from the Cobb Exchange. MLJ and his accomplices would make off with the $9,000 in cash and ditch the checks. But remember what I said about small towns? Word travels fast. Bill Kenny's story about the true amount stolen ran in the back of the MDJ. Rumors about Harold Willingham's deposit box had been swirling for weeks, and by the time the truth was out, the scuttlebutt stuck. To put these rumors to rest, once and for all, Cobb Exchange Bank President Neil Barfield set the record straight about the safe deposit boxes.
Now tell me a little bit about how somebody has a safety deposit box at Cobb Exchange Bank, because as you know, there were some running rumors that that room was targeted specifically because of the safety deposit boxes.
No, that is absolutely incorrect. They did not target that room. They didn't want to come up in that room. They wanted to come up in the money vault, which was not, it was on the same floor, but in another room, you see, out of sight from the public area there. You'd have to go into that next room, which we had a teller's line back there also. Had three tellers back there and five tellers up where you're talking about in the main floor.
Why do you think there was that running rumor that they were trying to get in these safety deposit boxes?
It's the first time I've heard it, to tell you the truth. First time I've heard that, because they did not want to be. There's nothing in the world in there that they could want. See, if they just wanted what was in a teller's window, they'd gone up to the teller, taken a gun and said, rob them. Give me the money. They wouldn't have gone on no bank building or under a major road, no. They'd gone in there with a gun and told the teller, give me the money in your drawer, you see. They could have even done that at the drive-in window.
So after the burglary around town, you've got some rumors, but it's kind of a running joke among local Mariettans that these guys had spent $1,000 on rent and allegedly only made off with like a couple $1,000 burglarizing the bank. So what was kind of the chitter chatter with locals at the time?
Well, it was just a unsuccessful bank robbery, is the way they considered it. Unsuccessful bank robbery. That they made a big mistake. The robbers did.
I don't know if I would classify the burglary as unsuccessful, knowing the true amount that was stolen. $9,000 in 1976 is the equivalent to about $59,000 today. Certainly worth the payoff. But there's only one way I can answer that question. We know who robbed the Cobb Exchange Bank. We know how they did it. We know how much they stole. There's only one thing left to do. We've got to find Morris Lynn Johnson. On the next episode of Robbery, Inc., I travel to Indiana to meet with Morris Lynn Johnson's next of kin, who gives me a firsthand account of MLJ's bank robbing days.
One time when we was on the run from the FBI, Dad had us three kids in Florida.
What was it like when they would come back home from a heist with all that money?
Really chaos, kind of scary. And they want me to shut up because I got powerful ghosts.
No.
No, I'm saying my ghosts are powerful. They may shut everything down. They will.
Robbery, Inc. is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Marietta Daily Journal. Robbery, Inc. is written and hosted by Madison Elizabeth Hogan. I'm on Instagram at Madison Elizabeth Hogan. This podcast was produced and edited by GPB's podcast team of Jeremy Powell, Jake Cook, and Mark Davenport. Special thanks to Olivia Watkin, Jaden Henson, and Rachel Kellogg.